Soundbite. Call the show now at 966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free 800-790-0415 or soundbites.org. Now, alongside Steve Ray and Dave Enright, here's Nick Francesco on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Good afternoon, Mr. and Mrs. America, and all the chips in the PC. It is Saturday, the 22th of December, Anno Domini 2012, and you lucky people. You're listening to Sound Bites. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Steve Wright.
And at 4 minutes after the hour, we're going to be bringing you news, used, things to choose, nothing to lose, kick off your shoes, don't get the blues, there's no booze.
Time out. 22th?
The 22th.
What's the 22th?
Today.
Is that like the 22nd?
It's like the 22nd, but it's the 22th.
Okay, I'll go with that.
Similar to the 11-1st?
Exactly. Exactly. All right, this news, if you're or anybody you know is on Facebook, which is pretty much a 99.9% certainty, you'll want to hear this. Your Facebook news feed is about to get more annoying, which I did not think was possible. The social network is getting ready to populate feeds with video ads. Why now? To attract big swaths of ad dollars from TV advertisers. That's why. By April, Facebook will reportedly have video ads airing on its desktop site and smartphone and tablet apps, so you'll be using way more of your data than you originally thought. Each ad will be likely around 15 seconds, will automatically play, although whether audio will be auto-triggered is uncertain at this point. Sources say that advertisers can display their ads up to 3 times to a single user across any platform in a day. And on the desktop, ads will grab a user's attention by expanding out of the newsfeed into web page real estate in both the left and right-hand columns or rails of the screen. Facebook's foray into video ads will look to grab big chunks of money, millions of dollars, according to Facebook sources. Facebook has also begun testing a system for users to send messages to people outside their immediate circle of social contacts for a payment of $1 as the company continues to find new ways to capitalize on its popularity. In a statement posted online, Facebook cited research showing that imposing a financial cost on the sender may be the most effective way to discourage unwanted messages and facilitate delivery of messages that are relevant and useful. Facebook already lets members send messages to those outside their network of contacts, but those messages are routed to an often overlooked other folder. I'll bet you didn't even know you had an other folder. This new feature would let users send messages directly to a user's main inbox. Each message sent will initially cost $1, although Facebook plans to continue tinkering with the prices. Only individuals will be allowed to send messages using this feature, so a brand such as Coca-Cola couldn't send bulk emails to groups of users, but of course any individual working for Coca-Cola could. For now, Facebook said it's... Facebook said it's limiting the feature to a small group of people in the U.S., capping the number of messages that anyone can receive through this route to 1 per week. New advertising rules may have lifted a major barrier to Facebook's long-held desire of signing up children under 13 years of age. The Federal Trade Commission, God bless them, watching out for us day and night in Washington, revised the Children's Online Privacy Protection Act, or COPPA, to exclude parental consent from ads that are based on behavior rather than personal information. So-called contextual advertisements would permit Facebook to monetize children's activity without violating rules about collecting their private information. So, our poll of the week at soundbites.org, that's bites with a Y, Francis would like us to remind you, is Facebook, video ads, message charges, and advertising to children. And the choices are, it's an abomination, I may curtail some of my Facebook activity, that's it, my kids are off Facebook, meh, no biggie, and face what now? And knowing the Luddite tendencies of our listeners, face what now is the number one choice. But boy, do I know you're going to have more to say about this. So when you're done with the poll, look at the yellow box underneath the poll, click on Give Us Your Opinion, and it will take you to my website, AskNick.com.
That's AskNick.com.
And you can leave a longer opinion. Keep it clean. We don't just we don't run Facebook. We're just talking about it. And then when you're done with that, of course, come on back here and give us a call. Let us know how you feel about Facebook's video ads, message charges, and advertising to children. Give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Or, of course, toll-free 1-800-790-0415, just like our friend Linda did from Greece, New York. Linda, how are you?
Good. Merry Rumball Christmas.
And the same to you.
I've got, okay, first of all, I don't understand Facebook, so it doesn't make any difference to me.
Okay, good.
Dave, I signed up for Soundbite Forum at the end of November, and I still haven't gotten the activation thing.
I told you you are already set. There's no activation notice.
Well, it said it's inactive until you get another.
No, go ahead and try signing on. Made it active.
Okay, now my question. Dave, you got my old computer, which you've destroyed, I'm sure. It had two hard drives in, a C and a D drive. The D drive had all my iTunes music on it. Okay. I backed it up to an external hard drive. Okay. My new computer has only one drive, a 1 terabyte C drive. Somebody told me, and I didn't understand what he said, that I would have to rename my external hard drive because it's a D drive in order to put it on my computer. Is that true?
Not really. The letters are pretty much arbitrary. The computer assigns the next open letter when you plug in the next hard drive. By general convention, your boot drive is always the C drive, though.
Okay. So, in other words, if I plugged in the external hard drive, which is the D drive for my old computer...
The letter doesn't matter.
Yeah, because if you've got a CD-ROM drive in there, that could be the D, which normally it is. So if you've got, say, a regular hard drive, that's going to be, by default, the C drive. DVD, which nowadays that's standard, would be the D. And depending on what port you put it in on the USB... is the letter that it's going to get assigned.
It'll just use the next available letter. So it could come up as an E or an F.
Okay, so...
Wait a minute, I think he's got to go...
Wait, I have a question, though, before we go any farther.
Okay.
And this is to Steve. Does this have anything to do with if she moved her iTunes database, it's going to look for all that music on D?
That's probably what the problem. The iTunes database looks for music based on the name of the volume on the Mac. And on Windows, I'm pretty sure it does look in the drive letter.
So she's right. Wants to just immediately get access to all the same music, assuming she copied her database over.
Then you go into iTunes under Preferences, under Advanced, I think it is, and there's a location button, and you tell iTunes the new location of your music folder. So it can be on an E or an F or a G or whatever letter you want it
there
to
you
be.
Go.
Okay, wait. Okay, back up. I'm confused. I go into Preferences, and I tell it to do what?
You tell it where your new hard drive is with your iTunes library on it.
Okay, so I tell it to do this. I tell it to put it in the C drive.
No.
No, you have to tell it where your music is now. Well, let's back up half a step. Do you want to take your music from that external drive and put it into your C drive now?
Right.
Okay, yeah, then you just copy that yourself into your home folder, into the music folder. So if you open My Documents and then open Music, that's where you drag the iTunes folder from that external hard drive.
That's so confusing for me. I'm sorry. The gentleman from Best Buy transferred all my iTunes music onto my computer.
Oh.
I just want to make sure that he got everything, if you know what I'm saying.
Well, okay, then you have to look at every file one by one and make sure it got copied.
Oh shit.
The assumption is they copied the entire folder. What you can do, what might be a little easier, is go into your music folder and do a right click and choose properties on the music folder on the C drive and see how big it is. You know, 93 megabytes. And then do the same thing on the D drive, or the external drive, because it may not come up as D when you plug it into the new computer, and see how big it is. And if it's within a few megs, they probably got everything copied right.
Right.
Okay. Yeah, because I had a funny feeling I was going to have this problem because I had two hard drives in my other one. I thought to myself, oh, geez, now what do I do?
Yeah, right. No, you should be good. You should be good to go.
Okay. Did you have any rum balls yet?
No, we don't have rum balls today. Dave is going to drop them off.
What?
To us individually. Well, I think he made a good choice as the weather is not conducive to rum balls driving home.
I know. Wouldn't you know it? We get the rotten Christmas weather today when you guys need it.
Sure, exactly. Exactly. All right,
okay,
thanks, Linda.
Have a Merry Christmas, everybody.
You too. Yeah, it can be... if you don't actually know how iTunes handles things and where all those little things are, it can be very confusing to get what you actually need to work correctly.
And that's why it's nice to have someone do it for you when you get your new computer. And then the assumption is that they did it right. So it's probably too late in Linda's case, but what you can do is if you open iTunes at the bottom of the iTunes window, it tells you how many songs you have. So, 8,406. And then when you get your new computer hooked up, see how many songs you have.
Yeah.
And see if it's the same.
And see if it's the same. All right. Back to the phones. Remember, you can give us a call at 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299 or toll free 1-800-790-0415. We're going to talk to Dave from Victor, New York. Welcome, Dave. What's your question?
Hi. I've got a 2007 iMac that I want to increase the size of the hard drive. And, it came with like a 320. I'm looking at a terabyte. I've been looking at Seagate and Western Digital. And it's difficult because looking at the reviews for both those, it just seems like there's always a large percentage or a significant percentage of negative reviewers. And that, I'm just in a little bit of a quandary as to what drive to pick.
Well, that's what you're going to find when you look at any review. The people that have bad experiences are going to post a review. People that have good experiences hardly ever do. If it leads, it bleeds is the... the other way around. If it bleeds, it leads.
Right, if it bleeds, it leads.
Yeah, so if something is bad, it'll get a lot of press. If something is good, it hardly ever does.
And traditionally, we understand that in advertising, for every one positive ad, you will get 10 negative ads.
But Seagate and Western Digital are both two of the more well-known brand names. In fact, they've been buying everybody else.
Have you found that the quality of hard drives in general has gotten worse over the years?
Well, along with everything else, a little bit, yeah.
One of the issues we've been seeing, especially with hard drives, is that most hard drives used to come with a 5-year warranty. And then it was 3 years, and now most hard drives are just 1 year, unless you buy the enterprise class drives, which are like twice as expensive, and then you might get 3 years. But in both Seagate and Western Digital, they all have different tiers. Western Digital has the green, blue, and black. The green is low power, and the black is fast. And so you pick, and then I think they have red, which is their enterprise. So you can choose whether you want a low power drive or you want a fast drive and you pay more for fast. And Seagate, they have their the Cheetah, the Barracuda, the different cat names. Yeah. The faster the cat is, the faster the drive. So you're gonna pay a little more for a faster drive. And usually if you're doing video editing or something that's really disk intensive, you have very large databases, then a faster drive may be worth the extra cost.
Yeah, that's what I want to do. Is I've got some video that I want to work on, and obviously I don't have the room, so that's really what's pushing me to the higher capacity drive.
Yeah. Right. The other problem is that replacing the hard drive in an iMac is a little tricky because you have to take the glass panel off, you have to take the LCD panel off to get to the hard drive.
Yeah, it doesn't look like it's going to be fun.
Yeah.
I think I'm capable, but I might get a quote. What it would cost to have somebody else do it.
External drives are often cheaper than internal drive plus installation. And if you go with a FireWire drive, then you're going to have the speed that an internal drive would give you. Not quite as fast, but usually fast enough. But FireWire drives are going to be more expensive than USB drives. So it's that old, you can have slow or you can have fast. Pick one.
Yeah. Are you in a position to make any kind of recommendation as to either model or for brand?
Well, at our store, we generally sell Western Digital. They're a little bit cheaper than Seagate, and from our experiments, experience, they've been just as reliable as Seagate. What we've been seeing inside the computers are Western Digital, Seagate, Hitachi, Fujitsu, all the different brands.
Yeah.
And one of the things we joke is that, you know, Apple ships 20,000 computers a day. So, you know, they're going to call up Seagate and say, I need 100,000 hard drives this week. And so whatever company can give them the best price, you know, if it's 50 cents cheaper from one company, they'll probably buy from that one, too.
Okay. Well, I think that's given me a little bit of perspective. And I think part of it is just, you know, I'm just going to have to take my chances, I guess.
Yeah, that's how it works.
Make sure you have a good backup.
Google, of course, uses a gazillion drives a day. A gazillion drives, I mean, in general, and they did a very long study, and the mean life of a drive is 5 years. That means some of them die out of the box, some of them last 10 years, and it's honestly luck of the draw. And they use every brand, every model, every part of the spectrum of cost, and that's what they discovered. All right, we're going to take a quick break. Before we do, in order to avoid all the letters we're going to get, we all know that a barracuda is not a type of cat. But we're going to be back in just a couple of minutes with Dave Enright, Steve Ray, me, Nick Francesco, and you. It is 19 minutes after the hour. We are the longest-running computer show in the known universe. Soundbites right here on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
It's America's longest-running computer show. Back to more sound bites with Nick, Dave, and Steve. Next on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And at 24 minutes after the hour, we are Soundbite, and we have Walter from Shalott on the line. Now, are you calling from Shalott, New York, or Charlotte, Virginia?
New York.
Okay, excellent. What
okay,
can we do
first
for
off, I wish a merry, blessed Christmas and a wonderful 2013 to all there.
Yeah, you too, my friend. Go for it.
Thank you. We upgraded from Ubuntu 10.04 to the 12.04, the long-term stable edition or service. And we did not like Unity, so we installed the GNOME fallback desktop. And that's miserable, too, because we get errors. It doesn't crash, but very often we come up with a thing saying there's a problem with that Ubuntu can't do something. So you click send a message, fine, and then you just continue on.
Yep.
I get problems with the video and that. I can go to a website, and they're just black lines through all a number of sentences until you put your cursor, and then the black lines disappear. So we're thinking is we might want to consider putting on XFCE 4.
Yeah.
And would that cause any problems? Because I've read online that if you have too many desktops, by the way, we'd get rid of GNOME, that fallback, but if you get too many desktops on there, and we're seeing a load of them still, they start fighting, and that may be the cause that we have with our displays.
Well, I haven't seen that at all.
Okay.
I have a fairly old laptop at work that I've got 7-8 different GUIs on that I play with regularly, and I've kind of fallen back on XFCE as my permanent one on that machine. Okay. I love it. I haven't had any trouble with it. I'm running 12.04 myself on that machine. Like I said, on my machine, it's a little slow, but everything was.
Oh, yeah. Everything's miserable now.
Well, but that's because it's an old machine. It's still faster than Unity or GNOME was.
Yes.
It's just an old machine. What are you going to do?
Yeah.
But I haven't had any problems with XFCE yet.
Okay. Did you download XFCE 4, or did you go through the whole rigmarole for the Zubuntu type, because then it throws on Thunar and a lot of other things that we don't want.
Yeah, but see, I threw all those things on. I upgraded right inside of Ubuntu.
Okay.
Because I figure, you know, if you're going to try it, the safest thing to do is to use everything they want you to use, because it's all designed to work together.
Okay.
That may be part of your problem. You've got to load, when you mix and match like that, you're loading a bunch of libraries that normally you don't load.
That's right.
And that's where your problem is going to lie. Yeah, you're mixing and matching.
Yep.
And that can very easily cause a problem.
Okay. Well, then I have our other thought that we had now is that we would partition our disk and put in a fresh load of either Linux Lite, which uses XFCE,
right,
or use Zumbuntu. Now, we do our backups with back in time. So if we had these fresh installs and we then added back in time to these installs, could we then use our backups with back in time and use that to add our home directory onto these fresh installs?
That's a lovely question. Back in time, I think, does a snapshot of a specific set of directories.
Yes.
So what you need to do is, before you do the upgrade,
yeah,
take a snapshot of only the directories you want to bring back.
Yep, that's what we have. Okay.
Then that should work. You need to, once you've installed XFCE,
yeah,
install back in time again.
Okay.
Right? Because that's the only way you're going to get it back.
Yeah. Well, we hope when we did the upgrade, everything back in time is all there. It's already on the menu. So it did a good job there. So I'm hoping we're just changing to the desktop with XFCE, we should be okay. But it's like I'm saying, if I'm looking to have an installation of Zumbuntu on a new partition, can we use back the data, the backups we have via back in time, and use that on the fresh install of Zumbuntu?
Well, again, if you didn't back up anything but your data, yes.
Okay, that's what we have. Well, we just, other than Thunderbird and Mozilla Firefox.
Well, but even those, if you backed up the hidden directories that those save data to, you're fine.
Okay.
But all of those, everything, the beautiful thing about Linux is that everything always happens in your home directory.
Yes.
So if you backed up your entire home directory.
Okay,
including,
no, we didn't.
Well, but if you do that, including all the hidden files and everything else.
Wow, okay.
You can then bring it all back into the brand new home directory.
Okay.
And suddenly everything will be there. It will be magic.
Okay, so I've got to go for the dot files, which back in time excludes.
Well, unless you specifically tell it to put them.
That's right. That's what I'll have to do.
Yep, okay. That's my point.
Okay.
There you go.
All right. Thank you very, very much.
Good luck. Have fun.
Okay. Bye-bye.
And that's the same sort of issue on Mac and Windows, that if you back up your home folder on the Mac or My Documents under Windows, you actually get all of your documents, your music, your pictures, your photos, and your email database, which a lot of people forget because that's in an invisible folder on Mac and Windows.
Right.
So if you just copy your documents folder, you're not going to get all that other stuff that you may want on the new computer again.
Right, and that's essentially what I was telling him about Linux.
Yeah.
In Linux, the invisible folders all start with a period, so they're called dot folders. And if you don't specifically back them, you can tell back in time to do that, but it doesn't by default.
Yep.
So you need to tell it, and you don't have to back them all up. You back up the .config and a couple of others, and you want to be careful what you back up. I should make Walter very clear about this. You want to back up the one that has your, I believe back in time actually says, do you want to back up your email, and then it gives you the choices, but I don't remember, because I use about 50 of them, and I don't remember which has which in it. But if you do that, make sure you only back up the ones that have data you actually want, like the Thunderbird directory, because otherwise you're backing up config files and a bunch of other things that you don't want to back up, because they'll be different under XFCE than they will under GNOME.
And you don't need. It's just extra space in the machine.
Well, and it can actually be dangerous. If you overwrite a config file that shouldn't be overwritten, that's a problem.
We had some interesting problems when Apple switched from OS 9 to OS 10, OS 10 based on Unix. A lot of people used to put periods in their file names to force a sort order. So you start a file name with period, and it's at the top of the list because period comes before A. So then when you install OS 10, they're all invisible.
Yep.
Because under Unix, if you start a file name with period, it means invisible.
Yep.
And we had a lot of customers call us up out of panic. Where'd all my files go? They're gone. Well, no, they're not gone. They're invisible. Boot back into OS 9 and rename them.
Yep, yep. Or you can do it from the command line.
Yeah, it's easier to boot back in OS 9 and rename them.
Maybe for you.
Yeah, I was going to say for most people.
For most people,
or in Linux, maybe you can do this in the Mac, too.
Yeah, there's a program called Tinker Tool that will let you show invisible files.
Oh, well, under most Linux things, if you hit Control-H, it will now show you the hidden files. And Control-H again will close them back up again. I don't know if that's...
I haven't tried that on the Mac.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. But that works on... every?
I doubt it works in the Mac GUI.
Every GUI that I've used, I think. I don't use KDE anymore, so because it just annoys the heck out of me. So.
It may work in Terminal. So it's a finder flag, to be technical, on the Mac, where it hides invisible files. But if you're in Terminal, it would probably do it, because that's where you're showing your files anyway.
Right. But but it's Control-H, I believe, to show or hide hidden files. It's a toggle. That's a pretty neat thing. All right, back to the new. Oh, we have somebody online? Oh, we do. We have Steve. We have Steve from Irondequoit on the line. Hiya, Steve. What's up?
Well, down, actually. I just assembled a new computer, clean install of Windows 7, and I'm having trouble installing a modem. It's a PCIe modem and an MSI motherboard. And when I put the modem in, generic drivers loaded. But then when I went to use the modem, connect to the internet, I got a note or a notification, your modem appears to be in use by another program or is not configured properly.
What OS?
Pardon me?
Windows 7.
Windows 7?
Yeah, Windows 7. Clean install of default settings on everything. Now, I opened Device Manager, and the modem showed up.
Mm-hmm.
But then, after a while, it disappeared. Fortunately, I opened the Properties menu before it did that. I'm getting a code 45 that it's not there.
Now, have you gone to the manufacturer and looked for a Windows 7 driver for that?
Okay, what I did, I called both the, actually the first way I noticed it was that when I tried to install the Windows 7 driver from the disk,
mm-hmm.
it said modem was not there.
Let me ask you a question, and this is digging as far back as my brain goes. Are you using a USB mouse or keyboard?
Yes.
IRQs?
IRQs.
Yeah.
We're okay, back to IRQ problems.
There are no conflicts showing.
No. That has nothing to do with it.
It wouldn't show a conflict.
Uh-huh. So how do I...
get a USB...
Which one do I have to lose, or do I have to lose them both?
Get a USB modem.
Get a USB modem.
Yeah.
Okay, all right. That was actually going to be my final question.
Yeah, that's
that would be easier.
Well, if you're willing to do that, that is the easiest way to solve the problem.
Okay, now, is disadvantages in terms of speed or anything like that? Or
not anymore. If you've got USB 2, you're already faster than the modem will be.
Yeah. Okay.
Just one other thing hanging off the back of your computer.
Well, and the other thing, though, is, again, you're only limited by the phone line. Again, you're going over copper.
I currently don't have a broadband connection that's in the near future, but the reason I need a modem is I have to activate my Windows.
All right.
Well, you can do that over the telephone.
Yeah. Pardon me? You can do that over the telephone.
Oh, I can?
When it comes up, it asks you, you know, it'll give you an 800 number that you can call, and it'll have the key code there.
Okay. Yeah.
And what you're going to do is, quite often, a lot of them, you can just speak it, and then they'll give you back a code that you would type in to activate it.
Okay.
Yeah, you can do that on an 800 number, because that's one thing they can't assume, is that everybody just is connected to the internet. I mean,
okay. Now there was one question that down the line I was going to try to get to. You probably mentioned if it's an IRQ problem, it wouldn't apply. It wouldn't help to change the port setting for the modem.
No, it's not. That's like I say. One, if that's all you're going to do is to register your Windows, don't bother. Don't even waste the money. you know, wait until you're ready to go to the internet, because 10-to-1 odds, the system already has a built-in network, you know, connection in it.
Right.
So that's not going to cause any conflict. You can call that 800 number, register your Windows 7 over the phone,
okay,
and save yourself money all the way around.
All right. Well, and the good thing, too, is that I'm still within the RMA period for...
Right.
Returning the modem.
Now, see, here's what you do is you also tuck that money away come spring when it's the Jazz fund drive. Boom, you're ready.
Yep.
I got a method to my madness here.
Okay. Yeah, right. That basically covers it then. Thank you.
All right.
There you
have
go.
Have a good one.
Bye-bye.
Yeah, we so often just gloss right over that activation screen, and because the default choice is activate over the internet now.
Right.
But the second choice is activate over the telephone, and we don't see that anymore.
Yeah, exactly. But it's there.
And I did post a link with the phone numbers and how to find your activation codes.
Right. Good. All right. The modems are getting to be...
very hard to find.
A lost art.
Yeah.
You know, I used to have, actually, when we hired students to work for us, mm-hmm, we actually had a requirement that they be able to hear well enough to troubleshoot modem problems.
Okay.
Which is tricky at RIT with the big NTID deaf school.
Right, but with that, well, that's why I put it in, because we had to have people who could hear the modems.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't mean that they couldn't, you know, they could have a hearing aid or the thing in the...
an assistant.
But they had to be able to do that. And we don't even have that requirement anymore, because we don't buy anything with modems. We just don't.
Well, it's just like even faxing. People don't bother faxing anymore. It's costly, and they'll just send out emails.
We still have...
although this still has a modem in it. This laptop.
Interesting.
I've got.
We still have a few customers that will still fax us POs, and we use a computer to receive our faxes, and it's an old thing in one of the back rooms, and we don't always look at it that often. So a customer will call up and, "Did you get my PO?" "Oh yeah, I heard something come in early."
Yep. But
we don't even have a dedicated phone line anymore. It shares one of our voice lines.
The fax was invented, what, in the 1860s?
The concept of the fax goes back 400 or 500 years.
Yeah.
You'd have two guys on a mountaintop waving, raising a flag to put a dot down on a...
No, but the actual fax.
Yep, the electronic fax machine in the 50s. But yeah, we had mechanical analog fax machines earlier than that, yeah.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes with Dave Enright, Steve Ray, me, Nick Francesco, and you. It is 39 minutes after the hour, and we are Soundbites, right here on the truly great,
member-supported
Jazz 90.1.
Online 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at soundbites.org. More with Nick Francesco, Dave Enright, and Steve Ray next on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And at 43 minutes after the hour, we are Soundbites, and we have James from Rochester on the line. Welcome, James. What's up?
Good afternoon. Yes, I have a 2-year-old Toshiba laptop that I always leave plugged in, basically never or very rarely utilizing the battery. What exactly is the proper procedure to make the battery last as long as possible? Someone said run it halfway down and then take it out. Can you run the laptop without the battery?
Well, if it's plugged in, sure.
Yeah.
I actually have a laptop that I do much the same thing with. It's the thing I print from.
Uh-huh.
And I just took the battery right off it.
And just run it like that.
What the way with it, a 2-year-old battery has the right kind of battery. A 2-year-old laptop has probably the right kind of battery in it.
Yeah, it came from the manufacturer.
What you can
the lithium
do,
batteries
a lithium
are different
battery,
than
yeah.
the old nickel metal hydride batteries we
right.
used to.
Right, with a lithium battery, the way you recondition them is to drain it completely.
Yeah, I did that because my power cord recently was unable to charge or run mm-hmm. the laptop, and I had to change the power cord.
Well, what you want to do is drain it completely,
uh-huh.
recharge it to full,
mm-hmm.
drain it completely,
mm-hmm.
and then take it out and only recharge it again when you're ready to go.
Oh, so run through the procedure once then.
Yeah.
And then re-drain it.
Yeah.
And take it out. Okay, yeah. How long do power cords normally last?
Oh, that's...
how long does a light bulb last?
Until your pet chews on it.
Yeah, I mean, 2 years old, and I had to change, and I put one. I happen to have in the basement one of those adjustable ones where you can buy with many different.
Yeah. When a lot of times it's the stress of winding the cord around the brick that that wears it out. Sometimes it's when you shove your computer up against the wall, you're kinking the cord. But there's generally there's no set life because cords don't wear out unless they get worn out through kinks and frays.
Yeah, and the laptop, the thing that plugs in the side there, there's always a bend in that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is it better to use a straight one or an angled one on the side?
That doesn't matter if you're not putting any kind of stress on it.
Right.
Huh. But if you're moving it around, you got to be careful.
Yeah, because people have the habit of all of a sudden grabbing the laptop and taking off, and it's still plugged in, and they bend that connector.
Yeah.
And then that means to get that fixed, we literally have to take the whole computer down to take the motherboard out, flip the motherboard, unsolder the old connector, and put a new one in. And that is very...
break inside.
Yeah.
And that is very timely and very costly.
A lot of the Macs have that DC in board as a separate board, and I really love that.
Well, you know,
but sometimes you still have to take the whole logic board out to get that board replaced.
No, the one thing that I wish had caught on, the Macs, and hear me now, remember me later, the Macs actually had the good idea for laptops is to have that magnetic.
The magnetic, yep. Apple patented that, so that's probably nobody else can use it.
Oh, but that is the slickest idea.
That's really nice.
Yeah, that's what I was wondering. Have they invented something where you don't have that problem on the side all the time?
Well, and Macs have it. It's a magnetic connector for the power cord. So,
but nobody else has it.
Right. You can if you trip over to whatever, it just pops right out, no problem.
That's Although we have had some interesting problems where people. We had a machine come in where they thought there was a wire dangling out of it. Turned out to be a staple that got sucked into the magnet.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks.
Yep. Bye-bye.
See, that's one of the bad things about a patent is that it prevents a good idea from spreading into other companies.
Yep.
There's been some interesting discussions on a lot of the blogs and podcasts about reforming patent law. And current patents run, 17 years before they can before anyone else can use that data. And that might have been good in the last 100 years for a mechanical device where there's manufacturing costs and development costs. But a software patent, 6 months if you're lucky to get your life out of it. That was one of the weird things about the Apple Samsung lawsuit is that all of the phones that Apple was suing Samsung over were long since discontinued.
Right,
because it was 3 or 4 years ago when this patent lawsuit started, so it was kind of funny to hear. All right, Samsung can't sell these phones anymore. Well, they haven't been in 3 years.
And Apple just lost another patent. So they'll appeal.
Temporarily invalidated. Yeah,
right.
Was it the pinch to zoom? Was it?
Yeah, that was it. Pinch to zoom. All right, back to the phones. Tim from Webster, welcome. Tim, what's up?
Hi guys. I really am not. Next year, I'm going to get into the smartphone thing and everything. I just have a basic understanding of it at this point. And I have an online presence with a health-related program that I want people to be able to have an app for. So what I'm wondering is, because I'm still kind of new to all this, how exactly would an app be defined in relation to someone having something that's available to others online? Then to follow up, where would I go to have someone build an app for me, and then what kind of costs are involved?
Well, there's a couple of things. An app is just a way to get data. You can make it personalized. So when I use the app, I put in my username and password. When you use the app, you put in your username and password. So I can only get at my data. You can only get at your data. So that's easy enough. In terms of creating an app, there are two ways to create an app these days. One is to create an HTML5 web-based app that is essentially running on the web. And all you get on your machine is a little front end.
Okay.
The other is to actually build a real app.
Using C or
one of a thousand different languages, including
Visual Basic,
Live Code, and a bunch of others. And it really depends on your app and what it is it's doing. Now, if you've got an app that mostly does things at the web end, you might just be able to get away with having an HTML-based app, which is essentially a web page.
It would be mostly video-related content that people would want to be accessing.
Okay, so they're going to need to download it and run it. You can still do it either way. That is your choice.
Okay.
To do it in either way, but you're going to have to talk to a couple of people who build apps, because I can say the average price is, but do you have an average app? I don't know that. Without sitting down and really looking at what your app wants, how would I be able to tell?
Sure.
There's a group in town called App Rochester.
Exactly.
Okay. And it's approchester.com. They talk about writing apps for iPhone, for Android, for Windows Phone. And it's guys that get together and talk about stuff so that you'll be able to get more information about how it works and what to do and maybe even find somebody to code it for you.
Awesome.
They usually meet the first Tuesday of the month, but since that's New Year's Day next month, they're going to meet on January 8th. They usually meet down at RIT Center for Student Innovation, the big curved building. Oh, shoot, the kid.
It's at approchester.com.
Yeah, I'll put that link up in a minute. The Cider had our meeting there last month, and the kid told us what the students call it.
The toilet bowl.
The toilet bowl, yeah.
Yeah.
Because it's a big circular building.
It's a big circular building, and the building behind it is a big rectangular building. So think about the circular building and behind it the rectangular building. What does that look like?
Toilet.
Yeah, and that's what
somebody's
they call
just got to put a handle up on the midsize of the building.
there's the senior prank.
And then, just put a big banner. Yeah. Please flush when done.
Yeah, right.
Okay, that information's fantastic. Can I ask one more quick question?
Sure.
I don't know if you guys can help me with this, but I want to be able to stream video content from Amazon, and it seems so simple. I can upload into their cloud, and I can't get the link to play on my... Is there some place I can go where someone can help me learn that?
I would suspect the folks at App Rochester are doing that sort of stuff all the time.
Oh, or any of the general users groups, too.
Right.
Oh, awesome. Okay, that's perfect then. Thanks so much for your time, and have a happy holidays.
All right, you too.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye. Yeah, it's the world is changing. It's all about the cloud now. It's all about being able to get your stuff to the cloud and from the cloud. Web apps, we have our friend Rick Harrison is a web app developer. And you have a multiplicity of ways that you can develop apps now. The problem is every platform uses a different language, a different setup, a different whatever. But nicely, interestingly now, there are a number of projects like
Live Code is
the big one that when you create your app, you can then save it in a format that is runnable by whatever.
Like 90% of your code is the same on all platforms,
right? And so you save it as an iOS app. You save it as a an Android app. You save it as a Linux desktop.
They even have
app.
Nook and Kindle.
They have Nook and Kindle apps. You save it as a Linux or Windows or Mac desktop app. And so you write it once and save it for all of those platforms, which is really pretty nice. But again, you just need to find someone, and this group can certainly get you in touch with those people, to write that app for you. And that's unfortunately, without knowing in depth what your app needs to do, I can't begin to give you a price on that. But those folks will be able to. You tell them what you need, they'll gladly give you a price.
We had a meeting at Cider a few months ago where we had an app developer come in, and basically, there's sort of like two sides of it. There's the concept developer, this is what I want an app to do, and then there's the coder that makes it happen. And so, can't remember the name of her app. It was a girl's app. Girl, but not girl. I'll think of it in a minute. But she was talking about that they had all the concepts and they looked at different ways to program, and they ended up hiring a contract programmer in another country because he was cheaper, and that turned out to be not that good a decision because of the time zone differences, and they always seemed to be having a problem and never got the code back in time when they wanted to. So it was an interesting meeting. We should have it in my Apple Cider history notes too. So as soon as I find out what month we did that in, you can go back and listen to their presentation at Cider.
People are finding all over the place that you still have iGoogle running?
It was the default in Chrome on this machine.
Nice.
And I keep getting that banner that says it's shutting down next year.
No, it shut down last year. It shut down this last November.
Then how's it still running?
Well, they haven't taken it away yet. They just won't let... If you leave that screen, if you say I want the classic screen...
I'm just going to the URL, google.com/IG.
Right, but somewhere, because you're using /IG. But if you go away from that screen and say, I want the classic screen, you can't get back.
I kind of liked it as a overview.
I loved page. It. I loved
and
it.
And it's not as crowded with ads as the Yahoo homepage was that I used to use for my overview. Here's the weather, the date, the time, the news.
Oh, no, it is November 1st, 2013. Okay. All right, I think we've got time to talk to Don from Rochester. Welcome, Don. What's your question?
Hi, how are you?
Good. How are
you? Great show you guys got. I've been listening to you for years, but I've never called because I never had a question. But now
thanks.
I do. I hooked my iPhone, my new iPhone, to my computer to download some movies and some pictures into my computer, and it turned everything to Apple, and now I can view the pictures or the movies. I can view some of the pictures, but I can't view movies at all. So I'm not. What do I do? Do I download?
What do you mean it turned everything Apple?
It turned everything Apple.
What do you mean by that? Apple is a company. I don't know what you mean by turned everything Apple.
The iPhone. When I downloaded the stuff from the iPhone, they all turned to a different program. QuickTime, I think.
Oh, that's the QuickTime movie player. That's to play movies on your computer.
Right now, when I open up the movies that were there already, they've all have a music cleft to them.
What program do you want to open them with?
I'd like to open them with anything that would show me the movie.
QuickTime will show you QuickTime movies.
What he's saying is they don't.
Maybe they weren't QuickTime movies. Maybe they were a media player or something.
Okay, so you're right. So when you click on a Windows Media Player file, it will open Windows Media Player.
So if I went to that movie and chose Media Player, it should show me a Media Player now?
Yeah, I think what he's saying is, it changed the default opener.
The association, right. But
and so now when he tries to open something, it's either not opening because QuickTime can't open that type of file.
Then it wouldn't have changed the association.
But it appears to have done so.
Yeah, it did. Because
I'm sorry, I know that you want to be defensive about this, but let's solve the problem.
Well, right,
I can't see the picture.
So the iPhone will take movies in QuickTime format. So you must have QuickTime installed to play a QuickTime movie from the iPhone. Your Windows Media Player movies still should play on Windows Media Player. So if you right-click on a Windows Media Player video, it usually has a WMV extension, there's an Open With command. And what is it? Shift right-click? There's an Always Open With. And then you can change the association to any other program you want. But to play a QuickTime movie, you have to have QuickTime.
I'm sorry, it's a new computer, a new phone, so I'm completely lost sometimes.
Yeah, no, I think you've got it. If you shift right click, you'll see an Always Open With, and if it is in fact a Windows Media Player file, select the Windows Media Player and it will open it from now on.
All right, I'll give it a shot and give you a call back if I got a problem.
Perfect. Thanks.
Thank you so much, gentlemen.
Yep.
Yeah, QuickTime can play a lot of different formats, but it doesn't play Windows Media format and shouldn't have changed that association.
Right. Well, it may have, whatever. It doesn't it doesn't matter. The point is that should solve this problem. All right. There's an hour gone out of your life you'll never get back. But we're going to do it again in another hour, and that'll be kind of fun, too. We're going to do it all over again. We're going to be bringing you a little bit of information before we do, and then we'll be back with a whole lot more of the longest-running computer show in the known universe. We have Dave Enright, we have Steve Ray, we have Nick Francesco, and we can have you if all you do is give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299, toll-free, 1-800-790-0415. And we will take whatever questions you have. We prefer them to be something to do with computers. because we're the longest running computer show in the known universe. Soundbites right here on member supported Jazz 90.1.
Show Soundbites on member supported Jazz 90.1. Get online now. Call 966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299. Toll free 800-790-0415. Or submit your question by email at soundbites.org. Once again, here's Nick Francesco, Dave Enright, and Steve Ray on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And 3 minutes after the hour, we are Soundbites. And here's an interesting story. The iOS 6.0.2 update released earlier this week may have cured some people's Wi-Fi woes, but others now claim it's reducing their battery life, too. First reported by Tidbit's Adam Engst and supported by a number of posters in Apple's support communities, some but seemingly not all iPhone users have begun seeing dramatically reduced battery life on their iPhones after performing the update. Apple says iOS 6.0.2 fixes a bug that could impact Wi-Fi, thus incorrectly using impact as a verb. iPhone 5 users previously complained about their complained that their devices weren't staying connected to Wi-Fi, therefore forcing their phones to fall back to cellular data networks and use inappropriate amounts of data. Although Apple didn't specify whether iOS 6.0.2 fixes that particular bug, it's widely speculated this was indeed its purpose. This change is how devices connect to Wi-Fi. This change in how devices connect to Wi-Fi may be related to the apparent battery drain. Speculation is that the problem is related to a change in Wi-Fi behavior, which maps with Apple's sole release note for iOS 6.0.2. It's far from conclusive, but indicates that the problem may be related to wireless communication in some fashion. Members of the Apple support communities are also seeing this phenomenon on their iPhones, but at least one user named .zaf. Has a different theory on what's going on. Quick update on this. I'm still getting my phone drained before I charge it again. It's been sitting at 4% for a few hours now, mostly idling, he wrote. Or she, or it. I have a feeling the phone is confused about how much power is actually left. Once it drains and recharges to 100%, excuse me, in one sitting, it should know better. And he's anticipating getting it getting better then. So is your battery draining faster after the update? Give us a call, 585-966-JAZZ. That's 966-5299, toll-free 1-800-790-0415.
So you guys ready for Christmas?
Not quite, almost.
Are we ignoring the story I just wrote? I apologize for reading it.
No. I just figured, because we haven't talked much about one of the other things, a question that I was brought up was... About getting stuff still, and again, there was a question here that was typed, about getting stuff via mail yet.
Yeah, you can still order things and pay for overnight shipping to try to, and then you quickly are going to have to pay for holiday delivery if you want to get it on Tuesday. But yeah, the Wi-Fi issue, one of the problems we see with Wi-Fi is the signal's never strong enough where you want it to be, and so you can tune the radios up so that it draws more signal in, but then it uses more battery power. So there's that trade-off between how much battery am I using and how far from the Wi-Fi source can I get.
And I have noticed that some access points don't work well with some devices.
Yeah.
So, for example, I have a Toshiba Excite 10LE. Android tablet, which I love. At home, I cannot play video on it. It's constantly stopping, stalling, buffering, not able to do it. If I take it into work, it performs like a champ all day long. I can play video all day long, never a stutter, never a problem, never a nothing. And yet, my Nexus 7 at home and at work play great, everything. So clearly, there's a problem with my Cisco router and my Toshiba tablet.
Well, there's or a problem. You have a business router at home.
No, it's the home.
Or could it be just Nick? Or could it be just the processors in the Nexus 7, which is a quad core?
No, because like I said, if I take the Excite to work, it works like a champ.
Really?
It never stutters. It never has a problem. It never nothing. And I've used it in a couple of other places, you know, hotspots places. Works fine. At home, on that particular router, it has a problem. I don't get it.
No, that doesn't make sense.
I don't get it, but that's the way it works. It works everywhere but at home. I mean, it works at home. I can do things on it.
But what about, say, if you were not at work, say, down on Park Ave or wherever?
That's what I'm saying. Hotspots at places, like if I'm in a coffee shop or whatever, the Excite works great.
Yeah, but all right. Here's maybe an enlightenment. Because of you being in the shadows.
Well, right, a Pinnacle Hill, that could be.
That might be, you know, because of everything flying around, that it could be so sporadic for you.
Yeah, that's,
you know,
that's
sometimes you could be really good, and then boom.
But it's just really weird, because when I first got it, I thought, oh, this is going to be great, and I couldn't play videos. And I got really kind of disappointed. And then I took it to work, because that's how you troubleshoot. You take it to a different place. Worked great. Took it to a couple coffee shops. Worked great. Just not at home. You're right. It could be Pinnacle Hill. It could be more sensitive to radio frequency interference.
Jim, by the way, said thank you.
Oh, that worked for Jim? Excellent.
Yep. He's a lot of folks procrastinate, you know, so, oh, well.
Yeah.
But, yeah, no, that one.
That was a question from some viewer?
Yeah, that's, yeah.
It's really, you're kind of past the point where you can get cheaper free shipping, but you can still pay for overnight. It's only the 22nd.
But some folks, it's like, hello? Where have you been? Christmas is only, you know, the same day.
I joke about the fact, right. It's not
every
like
year.
It snuck up on you this year.
We have an extra weekend this year, too.
Yeah, right. I joke about not starting my shopping till the 20th. If the date doesn't start with a 2, I don't shop. But I'm actually mostly done. There's one or two things I would still like to get my wife that I cannot find.
I think Jim there was panicking.
Yeah. Jim, we don't normally endorse any individual store, but let me suggest 11th Hour. It's designed for people like you.
Oh? What's 11th Hour?
It's a shop that's got earrings and candles and tchotchkes for the house.
CYA.
And, yeah,
better,
pretty much whatever you might need.
Better than the gas station convenience store on the way home?
Oddly, yes. Yes, you may not be able to get the little truck with the blinky lights.
Well, yeah.
But everything else will be there.
We have to get one of those little trucks at the gas station.
But yeah, I shopped at 11th Hour a week ago, so it clearly was only like the 9th hour for me.
Oh, okay.
But they have wonderful stuff.
There we are, 11th Hour gifts. I have 11th Hour Haunted House, 11th Hour Theater Company. There's a lot of 11th Hour somethings.
Well, I looked for 11th Hour Rochester, New York.
I did. And it's 11th Hour Gifts is the name of it.
There you go.
And I can't get to Facebook here at the school.
Right. Because everybody's using Facebook now. I have found that for things like earrings and rings and necklaces and candles and candle holders and cards and boxes and pens and little notebooks and name it.
Mm-hmm.
They've toys for kids. Name it. They've got that stuff. And
they're 12 corners.
They're 12 corners, and they are, in fact, they call themselves 11th Hour, so they know what you're doing.
Oh, okay.
And they wrap for you. They will wrap it and put a bow on it for you. I love those women. I go in there every year and tell them, if I were not a happily married man, you women would be in trouble. Because they wrap, they do the whole 9 yards.
See, I don't mind wrapping it. I kind of enjoy it.
Oh, no. Every single thing I wrap looks like an elephant. I don't care what it is. It looks like an elephant when I'm done. I'm just not. I'm not good at wrapping.
See, I'm very anal.
Yes.
That when I wrap, the seams, because the paper's got to be on one edge of the box, and it's got to fold it, and it's got to match.
No, I get that. Cut.
No.
No, I get that. I just can't. I cannot do that. I have long ago resigned myself to the fact that among my many talents, rapping is not present. It's just not there. I can't do it.
All thumbs.
So, I love to go there. Yeah, I want this, I want that. You put it in a box.
Hey, if it works, you know.
That's exactly right.
And then you're the hero, so
And nothing there is chintzy. So when she sees the box, she's like, "Oh, this is gonna be. It doesn't matter what's in it. It's good."
Well, you know, we always have to be careful about reboxing. Because we'll use the same boxes over and over again, and you open it up, JCPenney, or no, what's the big store that's gone now?
Sibley's?
Sibley's, yeah. We got a lot of Sibley's boxes, and you open it up, Sibley's! Oh, you've had this in the closet for 10 years. No.
we have a Kodak transparency paper box that has been in the family for probably 30 years, and it's still looking real good, but somebody always gets that box. Every year.
Do you keep the names on the box to who's
No, we should.
Off?
We should have. Like, see, we'd run out of the box by now.
Like that office manila envelope where you cross the name off and put the next one on it.
There you go. Wait a minute. Uncle Tim's turn to get it.
Yep.
He's not on the list.
Yep. Yep. And the other place I tend to shop, and again, normally we don't do this, but the poor guys, it's way past the 11th hour
now.
Yeah,
poor Jim.
The other place is farther up Monroe Avenue. It's called Cook's World.
Oh.
And they have, you know,
LA cooks.
Lots of, you know,
well,
cooking stuff.
Yeah, well, because I love to cook.
Right.
And I mean,
you get everything
cool...
from cool little timers and measuring cups to full sets of pans and everything.
The other thing I got to get, and I know this is not computer related, but, you know, talking about gifts and that, is a good copper kettle.
Oh, yeah.
For doing fudge.
Oh, yes.
Because that's one thing I was able to do that my sister Donna, God love her so, my mother used to always make fudge at the holiday
season.
My
dad always did, too.
And she's never been able to perfect double batching it. Well, I have. Mm-hmm. So, I have to rub it in. Mm-hmm. I took a picture of it and emailed it to her, and she goes, "Well, that'd be nice if you brought it over and shared."
Yeah. So, now you're stuck. Yeah, I get it.
We have a product at I think it's at our Webster store now called the iGrill, and it's a temperature thermometer that, you know, you stick in your meat or, you know, whatever you're cooking, and it's a wireless transmitter to your iOS device.
Nice.
I'm sure they have an Android version too. So yeah, you don't have to keep standing by the barbecue. You can be, you know, inside with the people, and your phone will beep at you when your dinner's got the right temperature.
Nice.
It's kind of neat.
Yeah,
we're sort of out of barbecuing weather these days, but should work for anything. Anything you can stick a temperature probe
in. No, as long as you got a garage, you're good.
Yeah,
I still do.
You have a detached garage too, so you got to bundle up to make that trek to the house.
No, I just if I get this morning I had to get up and get the snowblower out and on my tractor.
Yeah,
but if I can get a path,
you did not come to my house and snowblow my driveway. I just want you to remind you of that.
I would have taken me a little bit longer.
Yeah, would have. Like,
you're screaming 2 miles an hour on your tractor?
No, my John Deere, I bet you I move along a good 10 miles an hour on that thing.
There you go.
Hey,
traffic was only moving at 10 miles an hour at 7:30 this morning.
Yeah. Hey. Enough.
All right, back to the phones. Our next caller is Victor from Irondequoit. Welcome, Victor. What's up?
Hi, guys. I put a new add-on for my Firefox browser. It's called Do Not Track Me from a company called abine.com. And I don't know if it's a coincidence or not, but in the last couple of weeks since I've hit it on, I've probably dropped about 90% of my spam. Is that a coincidence, or do you think this thing really works?
Well, theoretically, tracking has nothing to do with spam directly. So it shouldn't be that fast a correlation. It certainly is a correlation, but not that fast. What tracking lets them do... because the whole point behind tracking is they know where you've been, and then they can send you ads about that stuff. So if they have, for example, already identified your email address and connected it with your IP address, then they don't know you're doing stuff anymore, and so they are sending you less spam because they don't know what to send you. So it's possible, I suppose.
Yeah, I'm pretty pleased with it. I mean, like I said, it's gone down easily 90%, and it gives you a little thing on the top of the toolbar. You can click on it, and it shows you what sites are blocked and so forth. It's a pretty neat little add-on. I just thought I'd share it with you guys.
I appreciate that. Do not track me, and that's for Firefox.
For Firefox, Chrome, Safari, Internet Explorer.
There's been legislation pending. I'm not sure if it's not quite legislation. The W3 consortium about a do not track header in URLs to stop advertising tracking, but the Apache Foundation, who make one of the biggest web servers used, came out and said they're going to ignore it in Internet Explorer because the standard says there's three choices: unset, track, and don't track. And if the user does not specify, then it has to be set to not track. Well, IE10, the standard is it has to be unset. IE10 has do not track on by default, so it's violating the standards. So Apache web server is ignoring the setting.
Interesting.
So Apache and Microsoft are arguing back and forth about the do not track setting.
Could I ask one more question?
Mm-hmm.
When I'm on another computer, let's say I'm at the library and I get my Hotmail, when I come home and I'll get on the computer again and my IncrediMail doesn't show any of the Hotmail emails. Now, when I'm at home and I have both on, I can see both. Is there any reason why that happens?
Yes. You can get your mail in two different ways. Are you saying that you're doing this online?
Yeah, when I'm online, let's say at a library or a friend's house, I'll get my email, and it's no problem. But yet when I get home, I also have IncrediMail. Sometimes there's hardly any emails on there, and I know that I've gotten like 10 or 20 when I use the Hotmail at another computer.
Normally, if you're using a web browser, it wouldn't delete the mail.
Yeah. Hold on, Victor.
Sure.
Stay on the line. We have to take a break. So stay on the line. We'll come back to you when we get back. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be back in just a couple of minutes with Dave Enright, Steve Ray, me, Nick Francesco, Victor from Irondequoit, and you. It is 20 minutes after the hour. We're Soundbites on member-supported Jazz 90.1. Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And at 24 minutes after the hour, we've still got Victor from Irondequoit on the line. Victor.
Yes.
Here's a quick question. When you're someplace else, did you say you were at the library or something? It doesn't matter. When you're on some other computer and you're doing your Hotmail, are you doing it directly from the web or are you using a program like Messenger or Outlook Express or something along that line?
Right from the web.
Wow.
Is there what happens when you use a program like Outlook Express and IncrediMail, things like that? It can download the mail to your computer and then delete it from the server, so you don't see it on any other computer. But if you're looking at it on the website, it shouldn't do anything like that unless you delete it on the website. And then you won't see it on the other computer.
Oh, I did. Yeah, once I see it there, I delete it.
Yeah, then you're
reading it.
Yeah, then you'll never see it on any other computer.
Oh, okay.
Because you're deleting it.
Okay.
Yeah, that's what's happening. Once it's deleted, it's gone.
Yeah, I just thought that because I had the IncrediMail that it would download it again.
No. If you've deleted it, and if IncrediMail has not seen it, and you delete it before IncrediMail can see it, then IncrediMail will never find it because it's gone.
Yeah, since you're using the web interface, you're looking directly at the mail server. And so anything you do is done on the mail server, so none of your other mail reader programs will be able to get that mail again.
Okay, well, thank you very much, guys, and have a wonderful holiday.
You too.
Bye.
Usually that's the way you want it to work, especially now when you've got computers and mobile devices. If I delete the mail on one device, I don't want to see it on the other device.
Right.
And if you set up your mail as an IMAP service, then that works. Unfortunately, Roadrunner here in town doesn't support IMAP, so you'll get all the same mail on all your devices, and so you delete all the junk mail on your phone, and you'll get that same junk mail again on your computer because it doesn't know any better.
Right.
At least they upped your mail quota to 100 megabytes.
That's
it used to be 5 megabytes.
Ludicrously small still.
Yeah.
Particularly when people are sending giant pictures around and everything else.
Yeah, you could go through 100 megs in a day or so.
Yeah, really.
The other thing Roadrunner just added is a data tracking service, so you can see how much data you've used on your Roadrunner account. I used 25.
Oh, that's ominous.
Well, yeah, I used 25 gigs last month. Usually what that means is they're getting ready to put a cap or a quota on. And so you have to have some way of tracking what you're doing. So if your quota is 100 gigs a month, then you know when you can stop without getting overcharged.
And, of course, if Facebook goes through with randomly showing you videos every time you go somewhere, you're going to go through 100 gig awfully fast.
Yep. One of the things it lets you do is see a time of when things were downloaded. And I've been finding my son is staying up at 1 or 2 a.m. because I'm getting huge spikes in Xbox downloads.
At least they're Xbox downloads.
Well, that's what I'm guessing they are, because all the other computers are asleep. It's got to be him and his Xbox. But yeah, so we're actually in a little better position here than we are in other cities. In many other cities, they do have caps. Typically, it's 200, 250 gigs for Comcast and Time Warner and other cities. But we've got the Stop the Cap guys here, Phil and Jerry, especially Phil, that really brought it to light a few years ago when Frontier tried to put a 5-gig cap. You know, and that's one movie.
That's one day.
One day of data. And so they're keeping a really tight eye on what's happening in the cellular industry and the internet industry in general. If anything happens here again in Rochester, they'll let us know. In fact, it got so bad when Frontier did that, several of the local politicians got laws passed in New York to say I forget exactly how it was worded, but you can't put a cap on unless it's necessary to your network management or something like that.
Yeah, right.
It isn't.
All right, back to the phones. Our next caller is Dave from Canandaigua, New York. Welcome, Dave. What's your question?
Good afternoon, gentlemen. I wasn't here for the first hour, so I hope I'm not asking the same question again.
Asked that one.
Next question.
Yeah. I'm looking at playing around with virtual machines.
Yeah.
And because I'm getting a little tired of the way Microsoft does things, but I still need to run some Windows applications that I can't get away from.
Sure.
So, there's actually a couple questions. First part is that there's two different kinds. There's one that run directly on the machine, and then the other types of VMware run as a component inside an existing OS. And I wanted to sort of know if there was any important differences between the two.
Well, that's pretty much all a virtual machine is. You're running another OS inside your current OS.
Yeah, there's three ways to run a different operating system. One is to do a boot. That's not virtual. Then you're running a real operating system or a different real operating system, and you have to reboot to pick one.
Right. I don't like that one.
Right. Then virtually, there are two different ways to do it. You get a provider who actually runs that system on their network, and you are essentially looking at the screens. The third way, which is the way most people do it, is they run a virtual system inside their own operating system. So I double-click on my Linux desktop, for example. I double-click a thing, and it opens up a window which runs Windows.
Right.
And that's a virtual machine inside my Linux box that's essentially a completely different and separate machine. And you can do it the other way, too. Run Linux inside Windows or on the Mac, you can do it and et cetera. Mm-hmm. So that's the what most people mean if you're not part of a large organization that can actually run a virtual server for you somewhere, or you don't want to pay to do it on Amazon or wherever.
I thought there was software that you could load. It actually loads before any operating system versus ones that are actually...
Yes, and that you're right. That is a separate way as well, where you actually pick... you use a product like ESXi or one of those, and that becomes... what do they call them? A virtual...
Wouldn't that just be a dual boot?
It's a hypervisor. It's a hypervisor, and then within that hypervisor, you load as many different operating systems as you want.
Right.
So you load up, when you boot it, you boot into the hypervisor, and then you say, oh, I want to run Linux, and I want to run Windows, and I want to run XP, and I want to run 7, and I want to run 8,
yeah.
Depending on how much RAM and everything else you have. Do be aware that they each require a decent amount of RAM. I mean, they require real RAM. So if you want to run three different devices, three different operating systems, each with 2 gig of RAM, you got to have 6 gig of RAM, plus the amount for the hypervisor. So you're looking at least an 8 gig system.
Okay.
Now, if you want to run two simultaneously, then you can get along, obviously, with two 2-gig systems. So that's 4 gig plus whatever you need for the hypervisor. So you can start them up and shut them down as often as you want. It's the number that are running simultaneously that you have to have RAM for.
Okay. Now, the switching between environments, is that as easy as switching between applications within an OS, or does it take time for it to sort itself out?
No, with a hypervisor, if you've got enough RAM, they just live in memory the way a normal operating system does.
Okay.
So you just switch among them without a whole lot of real trouble. Depending, there's Xen, there's ESXi, there's a couple of others. Depending on how fast your machine is, and some, if you're buying a new machine, check the machine itself, because some of them are designed to run a hypervisor.
Mm-hmm.
It's built into the BIOS.
I'll build a machine around it, basically.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And make sure you get a system that will do that, because then there's keystroke combinations you use to just switch among them. They can all be running simultaneously with the right BIOS. You can run them, you know, they run in the background even when you're not doing something. So if you wanted to start, say, a ray trace under Windows,
mm-hmm.
and then go play a Steam game under Linux, you could do that. And then you need a multi-core processor, because then you also say, well, I want to dedicate 1 core to this, 2 cores to that, 3 cores to that, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Ah, okay. Right, I see. And, well, I think that covers most of it. The other ones that actually run inside an existing OS, looks like, I've been reading that Oracle VirtualBox looks like the popular one, partly because it's free, but I guess it works pretty well.
VirtualBox is great. And there are a couple of others, but that one is great. Again, you dedicate X number of cores to it, X amount of RAM to it. Mm-hmm. So when it's running, now when it's not running, obviously it doesn't use any of that stuff.
Right.
But when it's running, it takes away cores and RAM from everything else. So if you run too many of them at once, everything is going to start to bog down.
Gotcha.
VMware has some nice features that it has several pre-built, what they call appliances, which is basically a pre-created virtual machine file with Ubuntu on it, or with KDE or another Unix on it.
Red Hat?
Red Hat, yeah. So they have pre-built appliances with different OSs installed. So you just download this thing, and poof, you have a virtual machine already up and running without needing to configure it yourself.
Right, and they can do that because, obviously, Linux is free.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I actually need to learn how to do all this stuff. If you don't like Windows, you got to learn to swim in a different ocean.
Ain't that the truth?
Yep.
So, all right, I guess that covers it for the moment. Thank you.
If you've got a fast enough machine, it's a great way to learn to do that stuff.
Yeah, you know, I got one pretty much built. It's got 12 gig of RAM and a good video card. And I do CAD CAM and a bunch of other stuff in Windows, but I don't need to run my business side of my business on there.
Right. And then you can use it to play. Make sure you have a multi-core processor, too.
Right. Yep.
There you go.
All right. Thank you.
Well done, Dave. Yeah, that's Dave's reaching out there. That's some pretty good stuff.
Sometimes it's a little easier just to have two computers.
It can be a little easier to have that, but also...
But if you want to run 5 VMs, then you need 5 computers.
Oh, that's right.
Or one giant computer to run them in virtual.
That's right. I've actually done that. I've got on my machine at work. We were talking earlier about, you know, what operating system do you run. I've tried them all, and I've loaded them all into VMs. So I've got about 15 VMs on my machine at work, which is a very beefy machine. I don't obviously run them all simultaneously, but I've got XFCE and XKDE and Red Hat and Mint and Ubuntu and, you know, in various flavors. So I've played with all of them. All right, back to the phones. Our next caller is Larry from Rochester, New York. Welcome, Larry. What's your question?
Good afternoon, guys, and Merry Christmas.
You too.
I have a question. Is there a nice, clicky feel full keyboard for the Mac? I kind of hate these Mac keyboards as they presently are.
The little flat metal.
Yeah.
They look. My daughter was even saying that. She owns a Mac, and she said, you know, they look so sexy, and I hate using them.
Yeah, that's where I am.
They're supposed to be designed for to minimize carpal tunnel, so the keys don't physically move very far, so you don't wear out your fingers.
Right.
There is a couple of companies that make them, and I'm trying to remember offhand what they are, and how to Google. How about Clackety Keyboard? You can run any USB keyboard you want on it.
You can put any US keyboard you like. So if you actually like a Microsoft keyboard, you can use it. You just have to remember that the Windows key becomes the Apple key. So when they say, you know, Apple T, you use the window key.
So let me say Windows.
And the Alt key is the option
is
key.
Apple key.
Right. And the Alt key becomes the option key.
And Alt goes.
Yeah, we have a couple of different brand keyboards at our stores. And
Mac Ales?
Yep.
Okay.
And some of them are different feels, and some people like the old mechanical, you know, I want a heavy key press feel.
Yep.
I just like that. I think I shall stop by today.
There you go.
Take a look.
Thanks,
and,
Larry.
One other question. I upgraded my Norton antivirus some time ago because it was warning me that I had 20 days, then 15, now 6. So I upgraded about 2 weeks ago, and I still get it popping up saying you have now 6 days to upgrade. If you don't, you won't have virus protection. Is that just going to go away, or?
Well, yeah, it will, because you'll be no longer protected. If you did the upgrade, you paid for a new.
Well, when I just went in, it was bugging me so much that I said, "Well, let me just go ahead and upgrade," because they were offering a new upgrade. So I tried to get a little bit more full of service for the PC than I had with the Norton when I got the PC.
It doesn't sound like it registered as being upgraded,
or it didn't remove the old version.
There you go.
So the old version is going to expire, but the new version's in there too.
Check to see if you have two versions.
Yeah, under the programs and start menu, see you might have Norton, say, 2012 and 2013.
Okay, now this is an iMac, so I'm still more PC-oriented than I am Mac, but would I find that in my Finder?
Well, you'll have to run the uninstaller from the original installation disk, usually.
Okay.
Because that's... The program is in the Finder, but the thing that's given you that warning message is probably a launch daemon, and those are a little trickier to find. But if you run the uninstaller, and in fact, I'd say uninstall everything and then reinstall the new one from scratch. But that uninstaller should be on the original disk as well.
Okay. That's not going to take everything off, is it?
No, just that program.
No, just the Norton original disk, not the Apple original disk.
Oh, okay, and what I upgraded to should still be there, right?
Right.
Yep.
Okay.
All right, going to take a break. Back in just a couple of minutes. Soundbites on Jazz 90.1.
Before you call into our show, please make note of the following rules. 1, turn your radio down. 2, turn your radio down lower. 3, remember, nobody has invented a good-sounding speakerphone yet. Don't use them. 4, make sure you have a point. It makes for a more interesting show. 5, calling does not guarantee you'll get on the air. No whining. 6, if you do get on the air, please do not tell the host what you just told the screener. We don't care. And 7, is that radio turned down yet? We hope this will make for a more enjoyable program, and we thank you for your time.
It's America's longest-running computer show. Back to more sound bites with Nick, Dave, and Steve. Next on member-supported Jazz 90.1.
Welcome back, everybody. I'm Nick Francesco.
I'm Dave Enright.
And I'm Steve Ray.
And at 44 minutes after the hour, we have Tom from Rochester, New York on the line. Welcome, Tom. What's up?
Hi, guys. Merry Christmas. Quick question. When I run Avast, when I do the Security Tango, I get a note that says some files cannot be scanned. And it says the error was because the archive is password protected. And I, when I look at these files, it's really, I've been inundated with these emails, which when I, you know, block the sender and block the domain, nothing stops the emails. And I am assuming that that's where these are coming from. Is there any way to, when Avast cannot get rid of certain files because they're password protected, what can I do?
Well, the first thing to do is to delete those files if they're not your files.
Yeah, well, I went and I tried. I went into the, it's in a, like a sub directory.
Sure.
You know, under the users. When I tried to delete them, it says that they can't do it because it's password protected. Oh, no, no, they didn't. That was what I got on the Avast. It said that I can't get in there because it's being used
by another system.
But if I can I do that like in safe mode? Would I be able to do it then? Or?
Well, you should be able to do it one if you turn off your email program. Shut down your email program.
Well, yeah, everything was off. And I just went through the, the directory.
Right.
And I went and I tried. I went to this temporary file. It was under like the under the C drive, users, my name, then app data, /unlocal, then /temp. And I just went to temp and I tried to delete that folder. And it wouldn't let me delete it because it said it was being used.
Yeah, the temp folder is being used by Windows. So don't delete that folder. Just go into it and delete the file.
Okay, to try to... Yeah, there's probably about 20 files.
Yeah, what you do is you select them all and hit delete. And then at some point it'll come back and say, well, I can't delete this one.
Right.
So you select everything except that one and hit delete. And you keep doing that until all those files are gone. Because there will always be some files in the temp directory that belong to Windows itself... And they cannot be deleted.
Right. They need to be running because other programs are running.
Because Windows stupidly uses the temp directory both for operating system temp files and for user temp files, idiots. Sorry.
No, you're right.
Now, if I was on access to my email and the internet as a user as opposed to an administrator, would that prevent any bad guy from... putting these files on my computer?
No, it would prevent them from running for the most part.
Okay.
And actually damaging your system because it means they cannot... Right now, if you're running as administrator, then any program that you download and accidentally click on or whatever also runs as administrator. That's bad.
Right.
It can still download them, but even if it tries to do something, it can't get at the machine... because you don't have the rights to get at the machine.
Right, okay. All right, so just try to just copy down the names of these files and go search for them and then delete them.
You got it.
But they're not password protected by the this virus?
Well, the program itself is probably password protected, but you don't care. You can still delete it. They can't password protect you from deleting it.
Okay.
And it's odd that a virus would password protect the file from opening because it would want to open and install.
No, click here to get the password.
Ah, yeah. Yeah, so they're trying to trick you into running the program.
Yeah.
Now, I run Windows 7 on my desktop, and every now and then I'll access my email and the internet with my iPad, all right? And where the desktop's not running, I just have the router on. Can anything ever reside on a tablet?
Sure.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Is there any type of a security system or a cleaner system that I can use on?
Not for the iPad.
Apple
doesn't let any programs get their hooks that deep into the operating system.
You can run Lookout, which gives you some protection. Warns you if you're on an unsecure network and things like that. But generally, no, because as Nick said, you can't get to the OS level. But that also means that the bad programs can't get down there either.
Okay, so I shouldn't really worry about it then.
No, you should. You just don't. There's just not much you can actually do about it.
It's the same sort of practices on your desktop computer. You know, if you get an email from someone you don't know, don't open it. You know, don't open links in email.
Right.
Yeah. Well, that's why it happened. I got an email from somebody that I knew, and I recognized the name, and there was just a link on there, and I hit it, And that's where I...
Yeah, never, ever do that
again. Never open any link in email, even from someone you know, because they could be infected, or a bad guy could be using their name to send out the bad programs.
That's what I realized after the fact.
Right.
Live and learn.
Yeah. Yep. Fortunately, on the iPad, virtually nothing like that will run, because if it's a Windows code, it can't run. If it's Mac code, it can't run. If it's HTML code, it could run.
It can run.
Yeah.
Java viruses
will get in that way, but usually their payload is a Windows code or Mac code, so it's fairly safe. But yeah, you do still have to be vigilant and not click links willy nilly.
Right. This Lookout, that's just a warning system for the iPad.
Yeah.
On the iPad, it is. On Android, it actually is an antivirus program.
Okay. All right, but there's no antivirus or malware things that you can run on the iPad.
Nope.
Okay. Alrighty, thank you for your help.
Yep.
We'll see you guys.
Yep. Yeah, who was it? Sophos? Somebody just put out their yearly threat
model.
And iOS viruses are moving up. Android viruses are moving up.
Matt, where do you come from?
Because mobile is where it is these days. That's the place to be.
Desktop viruses are actually moving down.
Yeah. Because most people have antivirus running. Most people are becoming more aware of what to do and what not to do.
Yep.
And viruses in general are dropping down because it's identity theft and credit card theft that are the new targets these days.
Yep.
Now, it used to be a virus was just sort of bragging rights. You know, I shut down that computer and it got talked about on the news. And then the bad guys figured out they could make money that way.
Well, exactly. And that's where it's all at now. You know...
What's the big one? The fake help desk support. Someone calls you up and says, you know, your computer has a virus and our systems have detected it.
Hi, this is the help desk.
Mm-hmm. Or they'll even say, this is Windows support.
Yeah.
I've even had a couple of people say they've had Macintosh ones where the people know Macintosh.
Nice.
Oh, you have a Macintosh. Okay, well, you know, here's how you do it on the Macintosh. And on the Windows ones, they always tell you to... to prove you have a virus, they say, well, look in your Windows directory for an INF file. That means you're infected. No, that's...
Because they always announce themselves that way.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
You're always going to have INF files in your Windows directory. They're supposed to be there.
Right. I got a call once from somebody saying, hi, this is the head of tech support. I said, really? He said, yeah. I said, I'm getting a call from the head of tech support. He said, yeah. I said, okay, what? And he said, well, I need you to do this, this, and this. I said, yeah, two things. First, I'm never going to do that. Secondly, I'm the head of tech support.
Yeah. What company are you, the head of tech support? Oh, I get those emails a lot. You know, the support team at Jesse Group has said that you need to do this. No, I didn't.
You're right.
But that's sort of unfortunate. That's social engineering is becoming more of an issue. We talked about that a few months ago with the Matt Honan hack. When his Amazon account, his Apple account, his Google account, his Twitter account all got broken into, they never had to guess his password. They called up Apple and said, hi, I'm Matt Honan, I can't remember my security questions, and convinced the people at Apple to issue a temporary password. They knew enough about him from public records. You know, they knew his address, they knew his name,
right.
and were able to convince them to issue a temporary password. So, you know, having almost a good password doesn't matter anymore because someone will just call up and call your wife or, you know, hi, you know, Matt wants me to help with getting his account. What's his password?
Yeah, well, that's why I always tell people, you know, when you're doing those security questions,
yeah,
lie.
Yeah,
you know, what's your favorite TV show? Orange. What's your favorite color? My mother, the car.
Yep.
Favorite number. No.
Green.
Yep.
Who cares?
Yeah.
Lie. As long as you know the answer,
the
computer doesn't care.
Right.
It doesn't come back and say, that's not a number.
And then the whole concept of password recovery can be the problem, because if you do forget your answers, you call the company up. And the company is going to say, what's your security questions? And you say, I don't remember. And they'll have to find some way to let you in. And particularly in the Matt Honan case, what Apple uses is the last four digits of your credit card number billed to your account. What they were able to find out is Amazon doesn't consider those numbers secure.
Yeah.
So you can see those numbers on an Amazon account.
Yep.
And so that's... So
yeah,
they got,
the rest of them are secure.
Yeah.
XXXXX, but the last four are not.
So they broke into his Amazon account by calling they were actually really sneaky. They called up Amazon. Hi, I'm Matt Honan. I want to add a credit card number to my account. And they said, okay, and took the credit card number over the phone, a bogus credit card. And then they log into the Amazon system, and now they called back and said, I'm Matt Honan. I can't remember my password. Here's the credit card number on the account. And the second guy said, okay, here's your password.
Yep.
And then you could see all the other credit card numbers on the account, one of which was tied to his Apple account. So the bottom line sort of becomes, don't use the same credit card on multiple accounts. Don't use password recovery, linking accounts together. So if you forget your Apple password, don't go to Gmail. And if you forget your Gmail password, don't go to Hotmail. In fact, a lot of people have been calling to just stop doing password recovery, period. You're an adult. You should remember your password.
Right. I like the two-factor authentication. If I call up, it sends a text message to my phone.
Yep.
If you've got my password but you don't have my phone, you can't get in. All right, we're done for another week. I want to thank everybody who called in. German music is coming up next. Look, I don't really care what you celebrate at this time of year. I just want you to go out there and celebrate the hell out of it. Have a great time. Have a great end of the year. We'll be back here, of course, next week before the end of the year. Now that we've missed the Mayan apocalypse completely, I actually bought a lottery ticket figuring, well, if it's the Mayan apocalypse, I won't miss the buck. We'll be back next week. Merry Christmas. And we will see you back here with the longest-running computer show in the known universe. We're Soundbites on member-supported Jazz 90.1.